That means we could start. We had to stop, inevitably, the long paragraphs in the middle of a very dense sentence, even, and it is involution of the womb consequence upon the menopause. Is that right? Do you have that, Patrick? Then we go on from here. There may be some difficulty with the text. We don't have it quite complete, but we'll see when we come to it. Okay, so we go on from menopause. The problem, and these are all medical problems having to do with birth in hospitals. So,
Chris, we have stopped at chromolithographic illustrations. Just to let you know.
We have stopped
at chromolithographic illustrations.
No.
Okay. Yeah, okay, then go. Okay, it's a bit farther down, yeah. Illustration. That refers to Aristotle's masterpiece, the book that I must have shown in the 10th chapter. These are housewifery and midwifery things and superstitions that are attributed by Aristotle, but certainly not written by him. And it has illustrations in it of fetuses and things like that. Okay, the gravest problems, and we go on from there.
The gravest problems of obstetrics and forensic medicine were examined with as much animation as the most popular beliefs on the state of pregnancy, such as the forbidding to a gravid woman to step over a country stile, lest by her movement the navel cord should strangle her creature, and the injunction upon her, in the event of a yearning ardently and ineffectually entertained, to place her hand against that part of a person which long usage has consecrated as the seat of castigation. The abnormalities of hare lip, breast mole, supernumerary digits, negro's inkle, strawberry mark, and port wine stain were alleged by one as a prima facie and natural hypothetical explanation of swine-headed, the case of Madame Gristle Stevens was not forgotten, or dog-haired infants occasionally born. The hypothesis of a plasmic memory, advanced by the Caledonian envoy, and worthy of the metaphysical traditions of the land he stood for, envisaged in such cases an arrest of embryonic development at some stage antecedent to the human. An outlandish delegate sustained against both these views with such heat as almost carried conviction, the theory of copulation between women and the males of brutes, his authority being his own avouchment in support of fables such as that of the Minotaur, which the genius of the elegant Latin poet has handed down to us in the pages of his Metamorphoses. The impression made by his words was immediate, but short-lived. It was effaced as easily as it had been evoked by an elocution from Mr. Candidate Mulligan in that vein of pleasantry which none better than he knew how to affect, postulating as the supremest object of desire a nice, clean old man. Contemporaneously, a heated argument having arisen between Mr. Delegate Madden and Mr. Candidate Lynch regarding the juridical and theological dilemma in the event of one Siamese twin predeceasing the other, the difficulty by mutual consent was referred to Mr. Canvasser Bloom for instant submittal to Mr. Coadjutor Deacon Dedalus. Hitherto silent, whether the better to show, by preternatural gravity, that curious dignity of the garb with which he was invested, or in obedience to an inward voice, he delivered briefly, and as some thought perfunctorily, the ecclesiastical ordinance forbidding man to put asunder what God has joined.
So here we go through some accidents of birth that can happen, and Joyce gives a whole list of it. The gravest problem of obstetrics and forensic medicine, sometimes these cases are brought to court, were examined with as much animation as the most popular beliefs in the state of pregnancy, such as the forbidding to a gravid pregnant woman to step over a country stile, lest by her movement the navel cord should strangle her creature, and the injunction of her, in the event of a yearning, ardently and effectually entertained, to place her hand against that part of her person, which long use it has consecrated as a seat of castigation. So these were all advice to women, as you find them in the Aristotle's masterpiece. It's really something about birth law. Then, the abnormalities of hair lip, breast mole, supernumerary digits, toes or hands or finger, Negroes, ankle, strawberry mark, and port wine stain. These would all be some marks on the skin, were alleged by one as a prima facie, that is in a court prima facie evidence is what everything else is based on, a natural hypothetical explanation of swine-headed. And then the case of Madame Grissel Stevens was not forgotten, or dog-head infants occasionally born. So there are all kinds of strange births, and you could have a dog hair child or one that was swine-headed. And Madame Grissel was a, I think, 17th, 18th century woman who kept in her rooms and was not seen in public. So the rumor went round that she had the looks like a pig, some kind of thing. So that is simply a rumor. The hypothesis of a plasmic memory, and that was a term in theosophy that has to do with rebirth, and they're saying there will be a memory. Advanced by the Caledonian Scottish envoy, and worthy of the metaphysical tradition of the land he stood for, many Scottish philosophers envisaged in such cases an arrest of embryonic development. And of course, embryonic development is what Joyce said is in a way the mechanism of the chapter, transformed into language development. An outlandish degree, delegate, sustained. Again, I don't quite know at the moment who this is, and you see they're always referred by different appellations according to the style. An outlandish delegate sustained against both these views with such heat as almost got conviction the theory of copulation between women and the major brutes. There could also be copulation like that. And it's women and the major brutes. It could also be the other way around. His authority being his own avouchment in support of fables such as that of the Minotaur, which the genius of the elegant Latin poet has handed out in the page of his Metamorphoses. And this is, of course, Metamorphoses, always Metamorphoses, one of the perhaps most important books of antiquity, of changes, and it is it's there that Ovid tells of Daedalus, who was a craftsman. This, of course, is the myth accompanying Simon Daedalus. He was an artist and at the court of Minos, King Minos, there was his wife, Pasiphae, who, for some reason, had a desire for bulls. And Daedalus fashioned a wooden cow where she could hide, and then a bull could copulate with her. You have to be pretty good to make a cow out of wood that would fool a bull, but he could do it. And the result was a mixture, the Minotaurus, as you know, with a body of a bull and the head of a man, and that might have had to be hidden in the labyrinth. So that is the whole story that is well known, and also infuses this. This is the myth belonging to Daedalus. The impression made by his words was immediate, but short-lived. He was effaced as easily as he'd been evoked by an allocution from Mr. Candide Mulligan in that vein of pleasantry which none better than he knew how to affect, postulating as the supremest object of desire a nice, clean old man. Nothing wrong with that, of course. Contemporaneously, a heated argument having arisen between Mr. Delegate Madden and Mr. Candide Lynch regarding the juridical and theological dilemma in the event of one Siamese twin predeceding the others. One might die, the other might live. The difficulty, by mutual consent, was referred to Mr. Carlos Bloom, to embarrass him a little bit, for instance, submittal to Mr. Coadjutor Deacon Dedalus, that's his title here. Hitherto silent, whether the better to show his preternatural gravity, that furious dignity of the garb with which he was invested, in other words, he's dressed in black like a priest, or in obedience to an inward voice. Inward voices are important in theology. He delivered, and you see the suitable word deliver, which can also be used in reference to childbirth, and as some thought perfunctorily, the ecclesiastical ordinance forbidding man to put asunder what God hath joined. As you know, I think Jesus was asked about divorce, and he said, man should not put asunder what God has joined in marriage. So this is a kind of medical dissertation on it. And now the next element I've always liked, and when there was no time to read the whole, as we do, only an hour for the whole chapter, I usually chose this, and you will see what it is like.
But Malachia's tale began to freeze them with horror. He conjured up the scene before them. The secret panel beside the chimney slid back, and in the recess appeared Haynes. Which of us did not feel his flesh creep? He had a portfolio full of Celtic literature in one hand, in the other a file marked poison. Surprise, horror, loathing were depicted on all faces while he eyed them with a ghastly grin. I anticipated some such reception, he began with an eldritch laugh, for which it seems history is to blame. Yes, it is true. I am the murderer of Samuel Childs. And how am I punished? The inferno has no terrors for me. This is the appearances on me. Terror in ages. What way would I be resting at all? He muttered thickly, and I tramping Dublin this while back with my share of songs, and himself after me, the like of a salt or a bulwurus. My hell and Ireland's is in this life. It is what I tried to obliterate my crime. Distractions, rook shooting, the Erse language, he recited some. Laudanum, he raised the file to his lips. Camping out, in vain, his spectre stalks me. Dope is my only hope. Ah, destruction, the Black Panther. With a cry, he suddenly vanished, and the panel slid back. An instant later, his head appeared in the door opposite and said, meet me at Westonrow Station at 11:10. He was gone. Tears gushed from the eyes of the dissipated host. The seer raised his hand to heaven, murmuring, the vendetta of Mananon. The sage repeated, Lex Talionis. The sentimentalist is he who would enjoy without incurring the immense debtorship for a thing done. Malachias, overcome by emotion, ceased. The mystery was unveiled. Haynes was the third brother. His real name is Childs. The Black Panther was himself the ghost of his own father. He drank drugs to obliterate. For this relief, much thanks. The lonely house by the graveyard is uninhabited. No soul will live there. The spider pitches her web in the solitude. The nocturnal rat peers from his hole. A curse is on it. It is haunted. Murderer's ground.
You see, this is quite lively, and you can see what it imitates. The 18th century, known for its reason, we just the previous paragraph had a lot of science. We have the Gothic novel, Return to Ghosts and Haunted Castles and Guilt and Murder. That was actually the origin of the murder stories, the detective stories. It arose from Frankenstein and Castle of Otranto and all of that, which was full of frightful things. And suddenly, Mulligan begins to say something, I don't know why. He comes from a party and talks about that. But that's all. Malachias's tale began to freeze them with horror. And you have to read this in a dramatic tone. He conjured up the scene before them. By the way, this chapter is a series of conjuring up the ghosts of writers of the past. But here he conjured up the scene before them. That's, by the way, what fiction does. It imagines something that should be convicted. The secret panel beside the chimney slid back. And you know them, the stories have libraries where suddenly one panel goes back and you have an underground passage or something like that. And in the recess appeared, and then you have these dots for the Haynes. So obviously, Mulligan reports something about Haynes, who was also there. And then, which of us did not feel his flesh creep? That has echoes of the boy that wanted to feel his flesh creep. Einer, der auszog, das Fürsten zu lernen. So there's a lot of echoes here. He had a portfolio full of Celtic literature in one hand. We know he went to buy a book, The Love Songs of Connacht, and in the other, a file marked poison. And of course, there's poison in these novels. Surprise, horror, loathing were depicted on all faces, while he eyed them with a ghastly grin. I anticipated some such reception. He began with an eldritch laugh. You probably have not often come to the word eldritch, but you feel it something creepy, for which it seems history is to blame. And now you can remember that Haynes in the morning said to Stephen, we have treated you unfairly, England, Ireland. It seems history is to blame. So that is now taken verbatim and is probably from the present put into an imaginary past. Yes, it is true. I am the murderer of Samuel Childs. And these Gothic novels often have murders and somebody is confessing and full of guilt. And how am I punished? The inferno has no terrors for me. And then he suddenly drops into an Irish kind of thing, and that is in the language of Sing, that Mulligan can imitate quite well, and here he obviously does. So that is no longer Gothic novel style, but that is kind of Irish. This is the appearances of me, there in ages. What way were I resting at all? He muttered thickly, and I tramping, doubling, this while back with my share of songs, and himself after me, some kind of ghost, the like of a sooth or a bull of horse, these are things to frighten children. So he drops into a kind of singlang. We know that he knows a bit of Irish. My hell and Ireland is in this life. It is what I try to obliterate my crime. And you have such Sebastian Melmoth condemned to wandering. Distractions, rook shooting, the earth's language. He recited some because he knows some Irish. Laudanum, which is both the medication and the poison. He raised his file to his lips. Camping out. It is interesting that the man, an English visitor to Ireland and to Tower, was later committed suicide. It was a bit strange. Anyway, his spectre stalks me. Dope is my only hope. Ah, destruction, the Black Panther. And you know, Haynes in the morning, first chapter, dreamt of a black panther and was frightened. So he must have been frightened. It's a suitable subject for the Gothic terror. The black panther. With a cry, he suddenly vanished and the panel slid back. A little later, his head appeared in the door opposite and said, "Meet me at Leicester Grove Station at 10 past 11. Now that's the present. He actually says to Stephen, "Meet me at Westland Row." So this sticks out from the historical language. He was gone. Tears gushed from the eyes of the dissipated host. The seer, that must have been George Russell, the poet at the party, raised his hand to heaven, murmuring the vendetta of Manana. George Russell wrote plays about Celtic gods, and Manannan is one that was mentioned, a kind of sea god. The sage repeated Lex Talionis. We heard of that in the seventh chapter. Lex Talionis is the law of the claw, as in Hebrew, the tradition. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It's a kind of appropriate punishment. And then comes something different that we already know or could have known, given a better memory than all of us have. The sentimentalist is one, is who would enjoy without incurring immense debtorship for a thing done. And that is the wording of the telegram that Stephen sent to Mulligan, who was waiting for him in the pub, but he sent the telegram, and that's a telegram from a 19th century writer, George Meredith. So you see, the whole framework of the Gothic novel is mixed with other elements that are not chronologically fitting. He drank drugs to obliterate. For this relief, much thanks. And you may have heard that already. That is, first, what in Hamlet, at the very beginning, the guard that has just been relieved says, "For this relief, much thanks." It's also what Bloom thought to himself about his particular physical relief through masturbation. And now here it's, "For this relief, much thanks." So the same quote can be embedded in different contexts. The lonely house by the graveyard is uninhabited. Now, one of the followers, an Irish author, Lefanu, wrote a novel, also a Gothic novel with murders, The House by the Churchyard, which is also a basis for Finnegan's Wake. So the house by the graveyard is uninhabited. And that reminds us and brings us back to Bloom on the way to the funeral, passing the house where one of the child brother was murdered, and his brother was accused and acquitted. Is uninhabited, no soul will live here. Decorative phrase, "The spider pitches her web in the solitude. The nocturnal rat peers from his hole." Remember, there was a rat at the funeral. "A curse is on it. It is haunted, murderous ground." And these are literal echoes of what Bloom thought. So the framework of the Gothic novel is filled with anachronistic later stuff, just even Bloom's thoughts about the murderer's house. So, and now at the end of the 18th, we move into the Romantic period. And the next paragraph is fairly difficult. It is De Quincey, who wrote the memoirs of an English opium eater. So it is a little bit under the influence of drugs and opium and not quite straightforward. It's a kind of a dream vision, not easy to follow. But now we listen.
What is the age of the soul of man? Has she had the virtue of the chameleon to change her hue at every new approach, to be gay with the merry and mournful with the downcast? So, too, is her age changeable as her mood. No longer is Leopold, as he sits there ruminating, chewing the cud of reminiscence, that staid agent of publicity and holder of a modest substance in the funds. He is young Leopold, as in a retrospective arrangement, a mirror within a mirror. Hey, presto, he beholdeth himself. That young figure of then is seen precociously manly, walking on a nipping morning from the old house in Clanbrassil Street to the high school, his book satchel on him bandolier-wise, and in it a goodly hunk of wheaten loaf, a mother's thought. Or it is the same figure, a year or so gone over, in his first hard hat, ah, that was a day, already on the road, a full-fledged traveller for the family firm, equipped with an order book, a scented handkerchief, not for show only, his case of bright trinketware, alas, a thing now of the past, and a quiver full of compliant smiles for this or that half-won housewife, reckoning it out upon her fingertips, or for a budding virgin, shyly acknowledging, but the heart, tell me, is study base moi.
I think we stop here.
Smile, but more than these.
We stop here. Yeah, it's long. By the way, I was wrong. I anticipated. Sorry, forget what I said before. That will come. And this is in the style, sorry, I was confused. In the style of Charles Lamb, who wrote a lot of essays. He's a kind of model for that. And his sister, by the way, committed a murder, so it's fitting. And here now we have that style. He's also, in a way, you might say, an inventor of the English essay, which is an art in itself. So, and it's contemplative. What is the age of the soul of man? As she, the soul, has the virtue of the chameleon to change her hue at every new approach. You realize this is also true of this chapter. It's also true of Ulysses in general. The shape changes. To be gay with the merry and mournful with the downcast, so too is her age changeable as her mood. And now we get a look at Bloom, how he grew up, which we don't know yet. No longer is he Leopold as he sits there ruminating, chewing the cud of reminiscence, that staid agent of publicity, the canvasser, and holder of a modest substance in the funds. So he must have some money put by. He is young Leopold, as in a retrospective arrangement. This paragraph is a retrospective arrangement, and you know that this phrase by Tom Kernan is repeated, because Ulysses is also in many ways a retrospective arrangement. A mirror within a mirror, hey presto, that is what the magician says when he gets a rabbit out of the hat. Hey presto, he beholdeth himself. So, although in some ways, Bloom is probably thinking of his own development as in a mirror. That young figure then is seen precociously manly, walking on a nipping morning from the old house in Clanbrassil Street, that's where Bloom lived, to the high school. His book satchel, on him bandolier-wise, and in it a goodly hunk of wheaten loaf, a mother thought. So he thinks of himself as somebody who goes to a school, high school. Or is it the same figure, a year or so gone over, in his first hard hat? At a certain moment, you get the hard hat, because the head was always covered. Ah, that was a day. All in the road, a full-fledged traveller for the family firm, equipped with an order book, a scented handkerchief, not for show only, his case of bright trinketware, alas, a thing of the past. You see this sentimental kind of comment, typical of some essays, and a quiver full of compliant smiles for this and that half-won housewife, reckon it out upon her fingers, or for a budding virgin shyly acknowledging. But the heart tell me his studied baisse-moi kisses. So it is Bloom going to school, or here it's Bloom already when he was obviously helping his father as a hawker, going from house to house, selling trinketware, probably brushes and things like that. So that we didn't know, that was Bloom. And Bloom, as you can see, has several occupations. We know he worked for a cattle market, he worked for an insurance, and he's now at that. So he's a man of many roles. Yeah, and then we go on with the reading, yeah.
The dark eyes and oleaginous address brought home at duskfall many a commission to the head of the firm, seated with Jacob's pipe after light labours in the paternal ingle. A meal of noodles, you may be sure, is a heating. Reading through round horn spectacles some paper from the Europe of a month before. But hey presto, the mirror is breathed on and the young knight-errant recedes, shrivels to a tiny speck within the mist. Now he is himself paternal, and these about him might be his sons. Who can say? The wise father knows his own child. He thinks of a drizzling night in Hatch Street, hard by the bonded stores, there the first. Together, she a poor waif, a child of shame, yours and mine, and all for a bare shilling and her luck penny. Together they hear the heavy tread of the watch as two rain-caped shadows pass the new Royal University. Bridie Kelly. He will never forget the name, ever remember the night, first night, the bride night. They are entwined in nethermost darkness, the willer with the willed, and in an instant, fiat, light shall flood the world. Did heart leap to heart? Nay, fair reader, in a breath 'twas done, but hold back, it must not be. In terror, the poor girl flees away through the murk. She is the bride of darkness, a daughter of night. She dare not bear the sunny golden babe of day. No, Leopold. Name and memory solace thee not. That youthful illusion of thy strength was taken from thee, and in vain. No son of thy loins is by thee. There is none now to be for Leopold what Leopold was for Rudolph.
Yeah. The scent, the smile, but more than these, the dark eyes and oleaginous address, oily a little bit. We don't really know what Bloom looks like, but here it says it, address brought home at duskfall many a commission to the head of the firm. Seated, that's his father, with a Jacob's pipe, that's a type of pipe, after like labours in the paternal ingle. A meal of noodles, you may be sure, is a heating. Reading through round horn spectacles some paper from the Europe of a month before. Bloom's father, with a horned spectacles, is reading newspapers from Europe because he's originally, as we now know, from Hungary, and he ended up in Dublin. And as Joyce did in Trieste, he wanted newspapers from Dublin, from his own place. But hey, presto, again the magician, the mirror is breathed on, and the young knight-errant recedes, shrivels to a tiny speck within the mist. Now he is himself paternal. This, of course, is the chapter of paternity and maternity. And these about him might be his sons. They're younger, maybe not technical, but you say that they might be my sons. Who can say? The wise father knows his own child. We had heard that before. There's a proverb, it's the wise child that knows his own father, pointing out the fact that you always know who the mother is, but the father may have disappeared and you don't know the father. This actually, I think, goes back to the Odyssey, when in the first book, Athene descends to Telemachus to put him on his journey. He asks him, are you the son of Odysseus? And he said, that's what they say, but nobody knows his own father, so it has a long tradition. He thinks of a drizzling night in Hatch Street, hard by the bonded stores, the first encounter. Together, she's a poor wave, a child of shame, yours and mine, and all for a bare shilling and a lucky penny. Well, obviously, Bloom had his first sexual encounter, and that was in Hatch Street, which is somewhere in the middle. But these streets always had a lot of trees, and at night they were practically empty. So that must have been a very, very quick affair. Together, they hear the heavy tread of the watch as two rain-caped shadows pass the new Royal University. It's close to the then new, now old university. Bridie Kelly, that is her name, very Irish. He will never forget the name, ever remember the night, first night, the Brian night. There are entwined in nethermost darkness the willow with a wild, and in an instant, fired. Copulation is in a way compared with the creation of the world. Fiat, lux, is what God said and made light of the world. Light shall flood the world. Did heart leap to heart? Nay, fair reader. Lamb often addressed the reader in a chatty kind of way. In a breath was done, but hold, back, it must not be. In terror, the poor girl flees away through the murk. She is the bride of darkness, a daughter of night. She dare not bear the sunny golden vibe of day. No, Leopold, name and memory, celestial not. That youthful illusion of their strength was taken from me and in vain. No son resulted from that. No son of thy loins, and that is very Old Testament Bible, is but by thee. There is none now to be for Leopold what Leopold was for Rudolf. So Bloom obviously here engages in a kind of reflection about his own, how he grew up. And now comes that passage I said before, and that is it's a kind of vision, and it's the original, right, or the style imitated is De Quincey, Charles De Quincey, I believe, who wrote famously the Memoirs of an English Opium Eater. So it is all a little bit vague and vague and not easy to read.
The voices blend and fuse in clouded silence. Silence that is the infinite of space. And swiftly, silently, the soul is wafted over regions of cycles of generations that have lived. A region where grey twilight ever descends, never falls on wide sage-green pasture fields, shedding her dusk, scattering a perennial dew of stars. She follows her mother with ungainly steps, a mare leading her filly foal. Twilight phantoms are they, yet moulded in prophetic grace of structure, slim, shapely haunches, a supple, tenderness neck, the meek, apprehensive skull. They fade, sad phantoms. All is gone. Agendath is a wasteland, a home of screech owls and the sand-blind Upupa. The time, the golden, is no more. And on the highway of the clouds, they come, muttering thunder of rebellion, the ghosts of beasts. Huh, hark, huh. Parallax stalks behind and goads them, the lancinating lightnings of whose brow are scorpions. Elk and yak, the bulls of Bashan and of Babylon, mammoth and mastodon, they come trooping to the sunken sea, Larcus mortis, ominous, revengeful, zodiacal host, They moan, passing upon the clouds, horned and capricorned, the trumpeted with the tusked, the lion-maned, the giant-antlered, snouter and crawler, rodent, ruminant and pachyderm, all their moving, moaning multitude, murderers of the sun.
Yeah, as I said, it's a bit murky. The voices blend and fuse in clouded silence, so in several voices. Silence that is the infinite of space. And swiftly, silently, the soul is wafted over regions of cycle and cycle generation. We had that before, the growth of bloom dwell on the soul that have lived. And now we have a region where grey twilight ever descends, never falls on wide sage-green pasture fields, shedding her dusk, the twilight, scattering a perennial dew of stars. She, and then suddenly we have a female, and we realize later it's a horse. She follows her mother with ungainly steps. A mare leading her filly foal, a mare, female horse, and a filly, female. Twilight phantoms are they. So that is what twilight phantoms, yet molded in prophetic grace of structure, the horses, slim, shapely haunches, a supple, tenderness neck, the meek, apprehensive skull. The horse looked as close. Then they fade, sad phantoms. All is gone. Agendat is a wasteland. Homo screechholes and the sound of Bupa. Metaim, the golden is no more. And you remember that Bloom picked up a leaflet inviting you to invest money in Palestine, and it was issued by the Planters Company, which is Netaim Agendat. So Netaim is a choice, incidentally. Or Bloom, or wrong, the Jewish word is Agudat, not again. So these are personified here as phantoms. A wasteland, interestingly enough, same year that Ulysses appeared, Eliot's Wasteland also did, and they're two important works of literature for modernism. Is a wasteland, a home of screech owls and the sign blind you poop out. The screech owl, take a moment. The screech owl is a translation of the Hebrew Lilith, but Lilith is also a mysterious and somewhat dangerous goddess, also the first wife of Adam. So these are Hebrew backgrounds. Yeah. And the sunblind is a hoopoe bird that I don't know. And on the highway of the clouds, they come. And here we have a whole sequence of beasts, almost like Noah's Ark. They come, muttering thunder of rebellion, the ghosts of beasts. Who was also what Bloom heard when the cattle drove was passed? Hark, who? Parallax stalks behind and goads them. The shepherd goads them with a trick. Parallax is, of course, an abstract. That is a way, an optical way of looking at the world. We heard that before. The lancinating lightnings, lancinate is the Latin for lightnings, of whose brows are scorpions. And then you have the elk and yak, the bulls of Bashan and Babylon, Manath and Mastodon, they come trooping to the sunken sea, Lacus Mortis, the dead sea. Ominous, revengeful zodiac host. They moan, passing on the cloud, horned and capricorned, the trumped with a tusked elephant has a trunk and a tusk, another, and the lion maned and the giant antlered, snouter and crawler, rodent, ruminant, and pachyderm, again elephants, all the moving, moaning multitude, murderers of the sun. So it's quite cryptic, but you see a kind of vision of a horse and then other kinds of animals mixed up with the zodiac, and then they're called murderers of the sun. Maybe a cloud coming between, but of course the chapter is murders of the sacred cows of the sun, oxen of the sun. So, as I say, this is in a kind of opium mist, not too clear. And it goes on like that for a while.
Onward to the Dead Sea they tramp, to drink unslaked and with horrible gulpings the salt, somnolent, inexhaustible flood. And the equine portent grows again, magnified in the deserted heavens, nay, to heaven's own magnitude, till it looms vast over the house of Virgo. And lo, wonder of metempsychosis, it is she, the everlasting bride, harbinger of the day star, the bride ever virgin, it is she, Martha, thou lost one, Millicent, the young, the dear, the radiant. How serene does she now arise, a queen among the Pleiades, in the penultimate antelucan hour, shod in sandals of bright gold, coiffed with a veil of, what do you call it, gossamer. It floats, it flows, about her star-born flesh, and loose it streams emerald, sapphire, mauve, and heliotrope, sustained on currents of cold interstellar wind, winding, coiling, simply swirling, writhing in the skies, a mysterious writing, till after a myriad metamorphoses of symbol, it blazes alpha, a ruby and triangle sign upon the forehead of Taurus.
It's still rather vague, also quite impressive as a language. So we have here the animals. On to the Dead Sea they tramp to drink, unslaked, and with horrible gulpings, the salt, somnolent, inexorable flood. Of course, if it's the Dead Sea, you can't drink it, it's salty. And you can't also, you don't sink. And the equine portent, that's quite a weighty sentence, the horse-like portent grows again, magnified into deserted heavens, made to heaven's own magnitude, till it looms vast over the house of Virgo. There's now zodiac is there. And lo, wonder of metamorphosis, change, it is she, the everlasting bride, harbinger of the day star, the bride ever virgin. Here I have to really look it up. The Virgo. Yeah. Here we are. Something of the zodiac. I just read here what I have. I don't quite see through it. The Virgo sets toward dawn. The Virgin Mary echoes the litany of Our Lady, metamorphosed into Millicent, into Bloom's daughter, who takes her place as Queen of Heavens among the Pleiades, a cluster of stars, the constellation of Taurus. Virgin Mary is the harbinger of Jesus as a day star, and the day star. When somebody important is born, there's usually a star to announce it. Not very satisfactory, I apologize. It is she, Martha, the correspondent of Bloom, thou lost one, echo of sirens, Millicent, Bloom's daughter Millie, the young, the dear, the radiant. How seen does she now arise? How serene does she now arise? A queen among the Pleiades, in the penultimate antelucan hour that is before dawn, shored in suns of bright light, coiffed in the veil of, what do you call it, gossamer? That's an echo of Bloom, that kind of, these fine webs that you see in the autumn gossamer. It floats, it flows about her starboard flesh, and loose it seems emerald, sapphire, mauve, and heliotrope. These are all colors sustained on currents of cold interstellar wind, winding coyly, simply swirling, writhing in the skies, a mysterious writing, till after myriad metamorphosis symbol, it blazes alpha, a ruby and triangle sign upon the forehead of Taurus. So it is the heavenly constellations, and very often in one is the alpha star, and alpha, it looks like a triangle, the letter ruby and triangle sign upon the forehead of Taurus. Taurus is a bull, and alpha is the first word of the Hebrew alphabet, and it means cow. It means bull. Alpha is shaped like a bull, and you will see later the triangle sign will be revealed as what it is. So this is murky and a bit, under the influence of opium. The next now is in the style of, the style of Walter Savage, Lander, who is not known now, but he put his tales into antique forms, and he gave all his characters the names of famous Greeks. And that's what we have now. and we're back, in a way, in the hospital where we can follow what is going on.
Francis was reminding Stephen of years before, when they had been at school together in Conway's time. He asked about Glaucon, Alcibiades, Pisistratus. Where were they now? Neither knew. You have spoken of the past and its phantoms, Stephen said. Why think of them? If I call them into life across the waters of Lethe, will not the poor ghosts troop to my call? Who supposes it? I, Bus Stephanumenos, bullock-befriending bard, am lord and giver of their life. He encircled his gadding hair with a coronal of vine leaves, smiling at Vincent. That answer and those leaves, Vincent said to him, will adorn you more fitly when something more and greatly more than a capful of light odes can call your genius father. All who wish you well hope this for you. All desire to see you bring forth the work you meditate. I heartily wish you may not fail them. Oh no, Vincent, Lenehan said, laying a hand on the shoulder near him. Have no fear. He could not leave his mother an orphan. The young man's face grew dark. All could see how hard it was for him to be reminded of his promise and of his recent loss. He would have withdrawn from the feast had not the noise of voices allayed the smart. Madden had lost 5 drachmas on Scepter for a whim of the rider's name. Lenehan is much more. He told them of the race. The flag fell and off, scamper. The mare ran out freshly with O' Madden up. She was leading the field. All hearts were beating. Even Phyllis could not contain herself. She waved her scarf and cried, "Huzzah! Scepter wins!" But in the straight on the run home, when all were in close order, the dark horse throwaway drew level, reached, outstripped her. All was lost now. Phyllis was silent. Her eyes were sad anemones. "Juno," she cried, "I am undone." But her lover consoled her and brought her a bright casket of gold in which lay some oval sugar plums, which he partook. A tear fell. One only. "A whacking fine whip," said Lenehan, "is W. Lane. 4 winners yesterday and 3 today. What rider is like him? Mount him on the camel or the boisterous buffalo, the victory in a hack canter is still his. But let us bear it as was the ancient wont. Mercy on the luckless. Poor Scepter," he said with a light sigh. "She is not the filly that she was. Never by this hand shall we behold such another. By gad, sir, a queen of them."
I think we stopped here. Remember. We stop here. It's a long thing. As I say, the manner of Lander, who put things into the past. Francis was reminding Stephen of years before, when they had been at school together in Conmee's time. This you can read about in the portrait, Conmee, the rector of Clongowes. He asks about Glaucon, Alcibiades, Pisistratus. These are all names that you know from, or have forgotten from, Athenian history. Referred to. So that's one way of dealing with antiquity. And of course, here we have also Bloom in the role of Odysseus. Where are they now? Neither knew. You have spoken of the past and its phantoms, Stephen said, previous section. Why think of them? If I call them into life across the waters of Lethe, will not the poor ghost troop to my call? Here, Stephen sees himself in the role not of Daedalus, the craftsman, but of Odysseus, who, in Hades, called them to life because he poured out blood and the ghosts came and he could talk to them. That's what it is. The ghosts troop to my call. Who supposes it? He says, I. And then he goes back to Bous Stephanoumenos. This is what schoolmates call Stephen in a portrait of the artists. And the words are taken up in the library chapter. Bous Stephanoumenos means a bull crowned with a Stephanos. Stephanos means crown. Stephen actually means corona. Stephanoumenos, so that is a Greek building. And it seems that before the bulls were sacrificed, they were given a crown or a wreath around their head. Bullock befriending Bart. Remember that early in the second chapter, that is, Stephen, who volunteered to bring some letters about the foot and mouth disease, he said that Mulligan would call me in Germanic alliteration a bullock befriending bard, somebody who does something for the sake of bullocks. I am lord and giver of their life. In other words, if you write, you can call up all kinds of figures. He encircled his guiding hair with a coronal of vine leaves. As I said, Stephanos means crown, corona, smiling at Vincent. That answer and those leaves, Vincent said to him, will adorn you more fitly when something more and greatly more than a cupful of light oats can call your genius father. So Vincent then says, it's all right, but you only have written, because authorship is also a kind of fatherhood. I've only written a few verses, and you have no right to call yourself a poet, and I cannot call your genius father. Fatherhood, creator, and all of that. All who wish you well hope this for you. All desire to see you bring forth the work you meditate. I heartily wish you may not fail them. Oh no, Vincent, Lennon said, laying a hand on the shoulder near him, have no fear. And there's a typical Menahan sentence. He could not leave his mother an orphan. Of course, you are an orphan when you don't have a mother. So Lennon always likes to turn things around. Then, at the moment of mother and orphan, Stephen falls back into his depression. The young man's face grew dark. All could see how hard it was for him to be reminded of his promise and of his recent loss. He would have withdrawn from the feast had not the noise of voices allayed the smart, softened the pain. Madden had lost 5 drachmas, stragma, because it's only Greek, on scepter for whim. And now we go back to the race. And it is no wonder that they think of the race, because before the horses have been very prominent. So that reminds somebody of the race that is now over. Or scepter for a whim of the rider's name, because the jockey was O'Madden. So he had bet because of a kind of superstition. Lenehan, much, much more. Lenehan, the specialist on horse racing, told them of the race, which he got from the newspaper. The flag fell on who? Remember, the who was already on the previous one. And there are some kind of relations between the two paragraphs in succession, which I won't go into. Who? Of Scamper, the mare. I had mare on the previous page. Ran out freshly with O'Madden up. She was leading the field. All hearts were appealing. Even Phyllis. Phyllis is, of course, a Greek name, often occurs in poetry. She's somebody the poet loves, Phyllis. So it's a Greek word. But Phyllis also echoes a young female horse, a filly, on the previous page. Phyllis could not contain herself. She waved her scarf and cried, "Huzzah, scepter wins." Of course, Lenehan wasn't there. He just makes a story out of what he has read. But in the straight on the run home, in all very close order, the dark horse Throwaway to level reached outstrip her. As we know, Throwaway won the race and not Scepter. All was lost now. Phyllis was silent. Her eyes were sad in nominis. "Juno," she cried, "I am undone." But her lover consoled her and brought her a bright casket of gold, in which lay some oval sugar plums, which she partook. A tear fell, one only. "A whacking fine rip," says Lenin, is W. Lane. He was the jockey of Norway. "Four winners yesterday and three today. He knows about the races, we don't. What rider is like him? Mount him on the camel or the boisterous buffalo. The victory in a hack camp is still his." So he said he could ride even on a camel or some road to win. But let his bearer for the ancient one. "Mercy on the luckless. Poor scepter," he said, a light sigh. "She's not the filly that she was." You see, filly, Phyllis. "Never by his hand shall be beheld such another." Shakespeare quote. Peg answer, a queen of them. And now we'll go on reading.
"Brother Vincent, I wish you could have seen my queen today," Vincent said. "How young she was and radiant. Lalaguet was scarce fair beside her, in her yellow shoes and frock of muslin. I do not know the right name of it. The chestnuts that shaded us were in bloom. The air drooped with a persuasive odor and with pollen floating by us. In the sunny patches, one might easily have cooked on a stone a batch of those buns with Corinth fruit in them that Periclopomenus sells in his booth near the bridge. But she had naught for her teeth but the arm with which I held her, and in that she nibbled mischievously when I pressed too close. A week ago she lay ill 4 days on the couch, but today she was free, blithe, mocked at peril. She is more taking then, her posies too. Mad romp that it is, she had pulled her fill as we reclined together. And in your ear, my friend, you will not think who met us as we left the field. Conmee himself. He was walking by the hedge reading, I think, a brevier book, with, I doubt not, a witty letter in it from Glycera or Chloe to keep the page. The sweet creature turned all colours in her confusion, feigning to reprove a slight disorder in her dress. A slip of underwood clung there, for the very trees adore her. When Conmee had passed, she glanced at her lovely echo in the little mirror she carries. But he had been kind. In going by, he had blessed us. The gods, too, are ever kind," Lenehan said. "If I had poor luck with Bass's mare, perhaps this draught of his may serve me more propensely." He was laying his hand upon a wine jar. Malachy saw it and withheld his act, pointing to the stranger and to the scarlet label. Warily, Malachy whispered, "Preserve a druid silence. His soul is far away." It is as painful perhaps to be awakened from a vision as to be born. Any object intensely regarded may be a gate of access to the incorruptible Aeon of the gods. Do you not think it, Stephen? Theosophists told me so, Stephen answered, whom in a previous existence Egyptian priests initiated into the mysteries of karmic law. The lords of the moon, Theosophists told me, an orange fiery shipload from planet Alpha of the lunar chain, would not assume the etheric doubles, and these were therefore incarnated by the
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's a problem, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but there's only been these were therefore incarnate by the ruby-colored egos from the second constellation. Our texts are not quite complete. Now, you remember her, Vincent. That's Lynch who says, I wish you could have seen my queen today, Vincent said. How young she was and radiant. Lalaji, that is a Greek name also for women admired in poetry, is no real person here, were scarce fair beside her, in her yellow shoes and frock of muslin. I do not know the right name of it. The chestnuts had shaded us, were in bloom, the air drooped, with their persuasive odor and with pollen floating by us. In the sunny patches, one might easily have cooked on a stone a batch of those buns with Corinth fruit in them that Periplepomenus sells in his booth near the bridge. So somebody sells fruit near the bridge. And this is also a Greek word. And I haven't been able to find out just what it means. The annotations we have say something strange. They say itinerant fruit merchant. Be sure it does not mean that. There's no fruit there. It looks like a participle that says sailing around, but it isn't quite like that. It's another name, something not solved. But she had naught for her teeth, but the arm with which I held her, and in that she nibbled mischievously when her breast too close. A week ago she lay ill, 4 days on the couch, but today she was free, blithe, mocked at peril. So obviously, he says his girlfriend, the name we don't know here yet, was 4 days, came, obviously had her period, and now that it's over, she could do things with less risk. She's more taking then, her poses too. Mad romp that is. She had pulled her fill as we reclined together. And did you hear, my friend? You will not think who met us as we left the field. Conmee himself. He was walking by the hedge reading, I think, a brevier book, with, no doubt, a weekly letter in it from Glycera or Chloe. Again, imaginative names of girls, to keep the page. The sweet creature turned all colours in her confusion, feigning to reprove a slight disorder in her dress. A slight disorder in her dress is also a poem. There's a lot, of course, of echoes. A slip of underwood clung there, for the very trees adore her. When Conmee had passed, she glanced at a lovely echo in the little mirror she carries. But he had been kind in going by, he had blessed us. That we heard, and now we have, I have to go back, because in the 10th chapter, with Father Conmee, who walks in the fields, and then at the end, I have to find the passage. Yes, Father Conmee, that's in the first section of Wandering Rocks. He walked calmly and read mutely the nouns, walking and reading, till he came to a certain passage. And then, that's Father Connolly, a flushed young man came from the gap of a hedge, and after him came a young woman with wild nodding daisies in her hand. The young man raised up abruptly. The young woman abruptly bent and with slow care detached from her light skirt a clinging twig. So this is now an echo of this, told not from Conway's point of view, but from Lynch's point of view. So now we know what happened, and the obviously they had been doing something between the hedges, and now just, and Father Conway blessed them, though they were probably doing something that does not deserve an ecclesiastical blessing. Yeah, and then he goes on. Lenin, the gods are ever kind, Lenin said. If I had poor luck with Barsi's mare, Scepter, perhaps this draught of his may serve me propensely. It so happens, and we see later, that what they're drinking is Bars beer. And Bars beer has a conspicuous red triangle on his label. In the foundation, we could see it. So I lost my money on Barsi's horse in the race, but I can now drink his beer. Of course, brewers are usually rich enough to run horses. He was laying his hand upon a wine jar, which, of course, the beer. Malachi saw it and withheld his axe, pointing to the stranger and to the scarlet label. A red label, scarlet, as you know, is the colour of adultery. Remember the scarlet letter. Verily, Malachi whispered, preserve a druid silence. His soul is far away. Because, as we know, Broom has gone into a kind of dream state with vision, and he still doesn't look quite awake, and so Mulligan makes fun of that. It is as painful, perhaps, to awaken from a vision as to be born. Any object intensely regarded may be the gate of access to the incorruptible eon, eternity of the gods. You're not thinking, Stephen. So he pretended to kind of theosophical act. Theosophus told me so. Now, there is no such person as Theosophus. It's a personification of theosophy, which was very much in the news and very much fashion now. It is a kind of synthetic religion, out of all of them, a kind of eternal truth with Kabbalistic things, with Persian things, with Sanskrit beliefs of reincarnation and all of that. That is theosophy, which Yeats and other people engaged in quite big. Stephen answered, whom in a previous existence, Egyptian priests initiated in the mystery of karmic law. Karma is what happens to you in every life. You build up a karma and this is then continued and you have to work it off in your next life. The Lord of the Moon, Theosophus told me, an orange fiery ship wrote from planet Alpha of the lunar chain. This is theosophical language. Would not assume the etheric doubles that we already read in a parody of a session. And these were therefore incarnated by the ruby-colored egos from the second constellation. And now we haven't got time for all of that, but we read a bit. Yeah, we can't finish, and I'll tell you where to stop then. Good. And the language is quite interesting. It doesn't have as far a prototype yet. It's different from the preceding ones. Or you can guess, perhaps there is something you know, and I don't.
However, as a matter of fact, though, the preposterous surmise about him being in some description of a doldrums or other, or mesmerized, which was entirely due to a misconception of the shallower's character, was not the case at all. The individual whose visual organs, while the above was going on, were at this juncture commencing to exhibit symptoms of animation, was as astute, if not astuter, than any man living, and anybody that conjectured the contrary would have found themselves pretty speedily in the wrong shop. During the past 4 minutes or thereabouts, he had been staring hard at a certain amount of number one Bass, bottled by Messrs. Bass and Co. at Burton-on-Trent, which happened to be situated amongst a lot of others right opposite to where he was, and which was certainly calculated to attract anyone's remark on account of its scarlet appearance.
Yeah, I think it would stop here. Hmm? And I wonder what you make of the language. Quite different. However, as a matter of fact, though, the preposterous surmise, yeah, you could say it is simpler, about him being in some description of a doldrums, that he was in a kind of lost or in a depression or other, or mesmerized, which Mulligan indicated, which was entirely due to a misconception of the shallower's character, was not the case at all. So it says it's not true that he is sort of engaged in the vision. The individual whose visual organs, while the above was going on, were at this juncture commencing to exhibit symptoms of animation. So it says Bloom, who is obviously thinking about himself, knows, no, I'm not lost in thought. I am as awake as ever. Symptoms of animation was as astute, if not astuter, than any man living. So he was quite sharp-minded. And any man living and anybody that conjectured the contrary would have found himself pretty speedily in the wrong shop. And you may realize what's in the wrong shop doesn't quite match the other style. So it's a very odd combination and not really a model of good writing. During the past 4 minutes or thereabouts, when you say 4 minutes, that looks like an exact indication. 5 minutes would be different, or 10. But 4 minutes or thereabouts. It looks like precision followed by imprecision. He had been staring hard at a certain amount of number one Bass's bottle. So this is Bass beer that has, as I said, a triangle. And perhaps next time we can show it. I forgot to do them. A Bass bottle by Messrs. Bass and Co. at Burton-on-Trent. It's a bottle that is still to be bought. And Trent, which happened to be seated amongst a lot of others, right opposite to where he was. I remember when the film Ulysses in 1965. Was made, I happened to be in Dublin, and they were doing this particular scene in a room, not in a hospital, and they put the beer on the table, and I said to the director, what kind of beer do you have? He said, oh, Guinness. I said, no, you must have Bass beer. And I remembered I ran around Dublin to get a bottle of Bass beer, which had a blue triangle, but it wasn't, and the director said he would show it, but you don't see it. So I feel cheated that my effort. It's not easy to get a bottle of beer in the morning in Dublin. Anyway, that's my own connection in that Bass beer, and they never paid me. Which was certainly calculated to attract anyone's remark on account of its scarlet appearance. Yeah, I think we can still finish it, yeah. Mm-hmm. So go on then, yeah.
He was simply and solely, as it subsequently transpired, for reasons best known to himself, which put quite an altogether different complexion on the proceedings after the moment before his observations about boyhood days and the turf, recollecting two or three private transactions of his own, which the other two were as mutually innocent of as the babe unborn. Eventually, however, both their eyes met, and as soon as it began to dawn on him that the other was endeavouring to help himself to the thing, he involuntarily determined to help him himself, and so he accordingly took hold of a medium-sized glass recipient, which contained the fluid sought after, and made a capacious hole in it by pouring a lot of it out, with also at the same time, however, a considerable degree of attentiveness in order not to upset any of the beer that was in it about the place.
He was simply and solely, as it subsequently transpired, for reasons best known to himself, which put quite an altogether different complexion of the proceedings after the moment before his observation about boyhood days and the turf horse racing. So you see, it's a rather complicated, full of aspirations, and it doesn't quite succeed. Recollecting two or three private transactions of his own, which the other two were mutually innocent of as a babe unborn. Eventually, however, both their eyes met. You realize? Both their eyes met. You see how useful the word both is? One eye cannot meet the other one. So you see it is full of awkward things like that. Both their eyes met. And as soon as it began to dawn on him that the other was endeavouring to help himself with the thing, he involuntarily determined to help him himself. And so he accordingly took hold of the medium-sized glass recipient instead of bottle, which contained the fluid sought after, and made a capacious hole in it by pouring a lot of it out with, also at the same time, you don't have to say at the same time. Usually things happen at the same, or you tell them and they're different. However, a considerable degree of attentiveness in order not to upset any of the beer that was about the place. So it's a complicated type of language and it doesn't quite fit. You will see much later, and by much later I mean it's the 16th chapter, which is written in this style on purpose, and it's quite funny in its ineptness. Anyway, it is put in here, and now we go on then next time, and we have then the, wait a moment. In the style of Huxley and of scientists, and it will be more difficult. So we move closer and closer to the present, and of course the lexical difficulties we had early are less so because the language comes closer to our own. I hope you enjoy it. See you, if all goes well, next week.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fritz.